Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we have seen the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is August 8th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here with us for the second installment of Communism in Germany, where we will be reading from Webster on the Internationale and the World Revolution. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And last week, we dealt largely with the issues related to the anarchists in Germany, and we were just finishing with Bakunin. And I believe we're going to be resuming with Bakunin and how they were organizing the revolution and how these people were basically professional revolutionaries who had no useful trade. And for that matter, they had no desire to engage in any useful trade. They just wanted revolution for a career.
Right. And Bakunin, you know, Nesta Webster, she compares him to a career criminal named Baron Ungern von Sternberg, who mm-hmm. had an island, his own island, Dago, off of the... In the Baltic Sea, and that would be off of the coast of modern-day Estonia.
All right. And obviously, people have to pay for this, don't they? Since if I wanted to become a full-time professional revolutionary activist, obviously I can't just write to the bank and say, hey, put my mortgage on hold, I'm a full-time revolutionary. I can't write to the grocery store and say, give me groceries on account, I'm a full-time revolutionary. Some Rothschild bank or agent somewhere has to put these people on some kind of salary so that they can pay their bills and support themselves while they're serving as full-time revolutionaries.
Well, there's no doubt. Marx made all his money from Engels. And the stock market, right. He'd invest the money that Engels gave him and put it in the stock market. If it wasn't for Friedrich Engels, Karl Marx was broke.
He would have starved to death.
No, he would have been a rabbi, like his two grandfathers were. And he would have made money in a synagogue and lying to the Jews about, you know, that they were God's chosen people.
But despite all the money he made through the stock market, he still let two of his, seven children starve to death? Two of Marx's children starved to death, literally.
Well, it's a criminal mind, I believe, the Jewish mind. And Karl Marx is definitely evidence of that.
What was it? Jesus said that, who amongst you, if your son asked for a fish, would give him a stone or a serpent? Well, we have the answer, Karl Marx.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what Jews do, right?
All right. Would you like to begin then, or would you like to discuss this Baron? Have you found anything interesting about this Baron?
Well, I went looking for Baron Ungern von Sternberg to find more out about him, and I didn't find anything about him in particular. The Baron von Sternberg that Nesta Webster is writing about was from the turn of the 17 into the 1800s, and that would be the turn of the 19th century. I did find a lot on Wikipedia and other websites about one of his descendants. Mm. And apparently, one of this Baron von Sternberg's descendants, the way Nesta Webster describes this von Sternberg, he's a criminal. He purposely led ships in the Baltic to their destruction so that he could loot and pillage their freight.
So
right?
He's a classic robber baron.
Well, yes, and that's what she calls him, is a robber baron, and he's a classic robber baron, is right.
And the term originated with the barons who lived along mainly the Rhine River. They would put chains across the river, and when commerce ships or fishing ships would try and come along the river, they would stop these ships and tell them you must pay a toll or else, and the or else was always, you know, motioning to the 20 or 30 knights and hired thugs that the baron, so-called, would have around him, and if you didn't pay, you were dead, and they were just going to take whatever you had.
Right, and often the royalty of Europe leased, and there's a video on the Mein Kampf project site I have called Judd Suss, where the Jews convinced this nobleman to give them the franchise of the highway so that they could charge people for going up and down the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And that was popular, a popular trick of the Jews in Europe, were to get control of the sea lanes and the highways from the noblemen by loaning them money and then extorting everybody that came by. I really think, I can't prove it. Maybe I can if I read Grimm. Maybe Grimm would prove it for me. I have a feeling, I can't prove it myself from what I know about history, but I kind of think that that's where the troll under the bridge stories come from.
The hideous Jew under the bridge who makes travelers pay for a road that they've probably built themselves.
Well, right, exactly. And I'm pretty sure in English common law, men were pretty much guaranteed the right of passage.
Well, I believe the Ohio Turnpike is owned by a firm either out of Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. They sold it to the Saudis or the Kuwaitis. And
it's the same thing. It's the same thing our country's doing here. The same thing that the German nobles did in Europe and the French nobles did in Europe. It was to sell the highways and sell the waterways to the Jews.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen the German movie Jud Suss, correct? It's on your website, isn't it?
Yes, and that's about a Jew cornering a prince and loaning him money and getting control of the highway from him.
And it's about, Joseph Suss Oppenheimer, the duchy, the Duke Karl Alexander of Württemberg granted him a monopoly on the trade of salt, leather, liquor, tobacco, banking, other things. He also established gambling houses, probably brothels, and I know that I believe he was given a controlling interest in the highway system, and ultimately he was accused of fraud, embezzlement, treason, and lecherous relations with court ladies, and then accepting bribes and trying to undermine the religion of the state, so eventually he was put to death.
Well, today the same things happen in America, but we call it corporatism, right?
Or we call it capitalism, but it's anything but, since traditional, what we consider free market enterprise, or what they call capitalism and Americans think is free market enterprise, just means you're free to engage in commerce without ridiculous restrictions or artificial barriers to entry of trade. You're free to open up your business, and you own the fruits of your labor. What the Jew considers capitalism means that a company is free to do whatever they want and exploit you in any way they want.
Well, right, basically. And they use the name of Adam Smith, that they invoke it as if it's almost their own religion, right? They invoke this name of Adam Smith in the name of capitalism, and Adam Smith's capitalism was nothing like Jewish capitalism.
No, I don't believe he ever used the phrase capitalism. He did talk about the unseen hand guiding people's actions and that they would do what was in the best interest of society because they'd want to have a good image and remain profitable. And when have Jews ever done what's in the best interest of anyone other than themselves and the rabbi?
Well, right, but I don't think that Adam Smith, he may not have understood the action of the Jew in the market,
mm-hmm.
which is not the unseen hand of Adam Smith.
No.
The unseen hand of Adam Smith was the general morality, I believe, of the people and
yes.
the guiding force that they would do what's right for their community. The unseen hand of the Jew is the hand that operates behind the scenes to loot and pillage the community.
Here, according to Wiki, they say that Smith proposes a theory of sympathy in which the act of observing others makes people aware of themselves and the morality of their own behavior, whereas it seems the only guiding principle in Jewish business is to loot the nation, pillage it, and leave it barren.
Well, it seems to me there probably weren't a lot of Jews in Scotland when Adam Smith wrote, right?
Well, he was writing about an ideal society, and an ideal society would have no Jews in it.
Absolutely. Well. Anyway, just this is an aside, but I think it's entertaining. Anyway, that there is a Roman Ungern von Sternberg, who must be a descendant of this criminal Baron von Sternberg of Nesta Webster, and it caught my eye because this guy is really slandered by the Jews, and he lived 120 years after the period that Nesta Webster is writing about. He was a commander of white army forces during World War I, and we'll find this out now. And this is from Wikipedia. During the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
Okay.
An independent and brutal warlord in pursuit of pan-monarchist goals in Mongolia and territories east of Lake Baikal during the Russian Civil War that followed the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Ungern von Sternberg's goals included restoring the Russian monarchy under Michael Alexandrovich Romanov and the Mongolian Khanate under Bogd Khan, and his opponents were mainly communists. Ungern von Sternberg was known for persecution of anyone who was helping his foes, the Bolsheviks, especially the communist and Bolshevik-oriented Jews. I'm surprised to see that on Wikipedia. He organized the only pogrom of Jews in Mongolian history. Following his Asian cavalry army collapse in Mongolia, Ungern von Sternberg was betrayed by two of his Russian officers and handed over to the Bolsheviks, Red Army, and Cheka. He was tried and executed for his counter-revolutionary involvement in Bolshevik Russia. Now, I'd like to quote one more little website, one more little paragraph about this guy. And this is from AsiaFinest.com. And they say, Roman Fyodorovich von Ungern Sternberg was an archetypical white Russian extremist. And born in 1886, a Baltic German, he claimed descent from a long line of military men, including Attila the Hun. And during the Crusades, his ancestors gained the reputation of being in league with Satan. I guess maybe they were selling out to the Jews. I don't think so, because this man actually was very brave and stood up to the Bolshevik Jews.
Maybe he was so brutal and so effective in combat, his enemies said that he must be calling on demonic powers.
Well, absolutely. It's they're really slandering this guy. They draw a real bad picture of him on Wikipedia, I think. They draw a worse picture of him here. And I think that shows how the Jew controls the media, because if he was standing up for the monarchy against the Bolsheviks, he sounds like a pretty good guy to me.
There's a reason I call it Jewikipedia.
And I'm thinking maybe there's a little more to this story Nestor Webster's telling about his might be his great-great-great-grandfather on this island of Dago, who is luring ships to their destruction. Yet, you know, if they were ships that were run by the House of Rothschild, then he was probably doing the right thing, too.
And speaking of going after ships, there is some compelling evidence that these Somali pirates in the boondocks of Somalia, with no technology other than RPGs and AK-47s, are receiving outside help from the Israeli Mossad in terms of information on the cargo manifests of various ships that are transiting the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and their location and heading. Since I don't think the Somalians, with a skiff maybe 20 feet long, could interpret where the ship is going to head or even spot the ship to begin with. And I have heard, I've read, and seen some evidence, and I conclude that the evidence is valid, that the Israeli Mossad has been informing these pirates where these ships are so they can go after them, or at least present the threat of piracy, thus weakening Egypt's commerce through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea, as ships now go through the Straits of Gibraltar and transit around the Cape of Good Hope around South Africa, so Egypt's economy suffers as less ships will use the Suez Canal. Israel is hoping to weaken Egypt that way.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Israel isn't behind all of that. That they're all of the regional unrest that we've seen in the Middle East, in the Near East, which is Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Africa, all of that regional unrest, I believe Israel has been behind for the last 120 years. There's no doubt.
Absolutely. I mean, how do you think a half dozen Somalian Negroes could take over a cargo ship from the Ukraine carrying tens of thousands of rifles, a dozen surplus Ukrainian Soviet-era tanks, rocket-propelled grenades, and crate upon crate of ammo? How would they even know what was on that ship? For all they knew, they were just going to land on there and it'd be full of bananas and oranges, and that's not worth anything.
Well, where are they getting all the advanced weapons from in the first place? They don't make a damn thing there. They haven't made anything there in 10,000 years.
Well, the Soviets in the 70s and 80s dumped a lot of weapons on the Somalians. So basically the white man arrived in Africa, handed them weapons, and the rest is history. As my grandfather said, that the Negro's always been violent. He's simply capable of killing from a further distance now since the white man gave him a rifle, and so he doesn't have to use a spear anymore. He can use the AK-47.
Well, that's all plausible, but it seems to me like a lot of their weapons are a little newer than that.
Mm.
I could be wrong, but That's from what I've seen on YouTubes and things like that. It seemed like that they were doing a little better than 40-year-old Russian rifles. That's immaterial. The Mossad has been behind all of the unrest. They've subverted all the nations surrounding Palestine, and they've been behind all of the regional unrest.
Well, what is their motto? By deception we shall wage war.
Absolutely. And anybody that doesn't play ball with them, that they get the Americans to invade. And that's why they've been beating the war drum for Iran for 5 years now. Okay, well, basically Nestor Webster is comparing Bakunin to this robber baron. This was precisely the creed of Bakunin, who, if he had lived 100 years earlier, before brigandage had been sanctified by revolutionary socialists and anarchists of France, would doubtless have found a vent for his energies on the same lines as the robber baron, instead of masquerading as a champion of the people. Such a dynamic force as Bakunin provided could not fail to be of immense value to the revolutionary movement, and thus it was that during his stay in London, Marx, who incidentally had the opportunity of Bakunin's incarceration at Königstein in 1850, to declare that he was an agent of the Russian government, I guess that's like saying you're a Fed today, right? Came round to his lodgings and assured him that he had not intended to calumniate him in the past. The fact is that Marx was now very busy at the great scheme of his life and needed all the cooperation he could muster. This scheme was the organization of the famous Internationale. In order to
she's basically saying that had Bakunin not been a revolutionary agitator, supposedly championing the cause of the people, he would have been an exploiter of the people.
Well, absolutely. That's what she said.
Just the same way in Russia now, all the former Soviet KGB operatives, they're now all champions of capitalism, openness, freedom, and democracy because the name of the game has changed, but the game is still the same.
Well, look at all the charities and all the religions founded by Jews here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
When a Jew wants a good job, he forms a charity.
So the theme and the rules basically remain the same, but the name of the game, you know, you're still playing Monopoly. It's just not called Monopoly anymore, and the Jews have that monopoly.
Absolutely. In order to understand the origin of this association, it is necessary to go back 2 years. That is to say, to 1862, the year of the Great Exhibition in the Cromwell Road. Now, whilst anarchists and state socialists were striving for the mastery over the revolutionary movement, the working men of France had begun dimly to realize that if they hoped to improve their lot, it was to themselves that they must look for salvation and not to the theorists which had hitherto led them to disaster, which is a reference back to the 1848 revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Accordingly, in 1862, a deputation of French working men was sent to England on a visit to the Great Exhibition and to study technical questions connected with labor. And during the course of their stay, they had the opportunity to observe the utility of trade unions in protecting the interests of the workers. This system was denied to them, for the coalitions of working men, suppressed in the first French Revolution, still remained under the ban. So that was exactly the opposite of what its intended effect was, right? And the Frenchmen now resolved to form a new association on their own account. Although imbued with the mutualist theories of Proudhon, their program was in no way revolutionary, and they hoped by pacific means to bring about a reorganization of the industrial system. An interesting little book, which has now become very rare, The Secret History of the Internationale, published in 1872, had admirably described the attitude towards the revolution, towards the social problem of these two men, Tolain and Fribourg, bronze workers of Paris, who visited London in 1864. They talked of peace, of study, of arrangement, of association, a better knowledge of each other, a more frequent interchange of thought, a clearer view of the great laws which govern and rise, which govern rise and fall in wages, and a means of stretching friendly hands from town to town, from sea to sea, in case of need. These are the ends we have in view, they urged, not secret plots and wine shop agitations. The path of peaceful progress was paved the more smoothly by the action of Napoleon III, who in May of this same year repealed the laws against trade unions and replaced them by a fresh edict threatening with punishment any concerted attempt, either on the part of employers or employed, to paralyze industry by malicious strikes or lockouts. This year of 1864, as Mermoud points out, was thus a great date in the history of the workers of France, whose lot has not improved since.
Right? So undoubtedly, the Jews in France at this point felt that they had to do something to destabilize France, and I think that's why they spent the next several years galvanizing Prussia and the other German states against France and France against them until they pushed it into a crisis with the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-1871, which resulted in a total defeat for France, the unification of Germany under Prussia, and it also resulted in the Paris Commune in 1871.
But a new law at last establishes equality of rights between the masters and the working men. You're probably absolutely right. And if firmly applied, it should have accustomed them to respect each other. It would not have permitted the method of direct action, which is nothing but a series of fraudulent maneuvers concerted and carried out. There was, however, at this moment, less reason than ever to have recourse to violent methods for the redress of social evils. But through the work of the world revolutionists, is always to strangle true reforms at their birth, like the Tea Party movement, right? And the new liberty accorded to the workers proved the signal for fresh agitation on their part. In the Working Men's Association, they saw the very instrument they needed for carrying out their plans. Karl Marx was then in London and frequently to be found in the clubs and cafes where the working men foregathered, even though he never had a job. In the evil hour, says the secret history, the Paris Bronzières met this learned and unsmiling Jew. From that moment, the cause of the workers was lost. Just like the cause of the Tea Party people as soon as they met Sarah Palin, right? It's the same pattern all over again.
Well, she's just going to lead them down a dead-end path that ends nowhere except with misery, disappointment, and maybe some people going to prison due to agent provocateurs.
Well, right, and then we'll have another Democratic Negro president after that.
The Republicans and Democrats are going to compete to see who can bring out the most unique, diverse milestone of a president. They'll say, elect Bobby Jindal, the first Indian man, from the Republican Party. Let's elect him. And then they'll say, let's elect Sarah Palin, the first woman, and it'll just be back and forth. Maybe next it'll be the first transgendered freak.
Well, right, but they keep on offering the normal people hope. And then they keep on offering the freaks consolation, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a back and forth. It's absolutely mad. It's a crazy system, and we're never going to have a political solution to our woes today.
People keep talking about freedom and democracy and liberty. And I got into a spat with some folks online, and I said that most Americans don't have a concept of freedom. I said, you people think freedom means that you're free to seduce your neighbor's wife and the state will protect you from him rightly gunning you down when the enraged husband finds out what you've done with his wife. And I said, that's not freedom. Freedom isn't freedom to be a pervert, freedom to seduce little boys or commit infidelity with your neighbor's wife. Freedom means that you're free to keep the fruits of your labor. And if the government said tomorrow you're going to pay 80% in income taxes, you would grin and take it and call yourself free. But if they said you can only have one sexual partner over the next 5 years and you can only drink a case of beer a month, you'd be in the streets burning and looting.
Well, that's it. I mean, we've seen that with the Communist Manifesto. We've seen it with the with the Protocols of Zion. We've seen it with the Bolshevik Revolution. We've seen it with the Weimar Republic. And we saw it with the Frankfurt School and America in the 1960s, 50s, and 60s. The freedom to the Jew is freedom to be a pervert in a sexually debauched society.
Yes. People measure their freedom in terms of how free they are to debase themselves, disrespect their body, and disrespect others.
And to debase each other's, right? If you try to protect your daughter, you're an evil authoritarian male, according to the Jewish Frankfurt School.
And they say, how dare you interfere with who your daughter dates? She should be able to date whoever she wants and be happy. Well, what if she wants to date 30 guys that just want her for an evening?
Well, right. They've used psychology and psychiatry to legitimize the destruction of Christian morals and Christian society. And we let them do it.
When
I make the statements that America deserves to be punished, people wonder why I say that, because most Americans seem to be moral. Well, most Americans are moral, but they haven't spoke out against this sin. They've accepted it. They still turn those televisions on every night and watch these same devils that pumped all that crap into our heads in the 50s and 60s that made us accept this crap.
That's the great sin of Sodom, isn't it? It's not so much that they're committing evil, which they were. It's that the otherwise decent people didn't speak out, they didn't say anything, and they were basically passive accomplices in the evil by remaining silent.
Right. And here we see a pattern in Nesta Webster where the Jew identifies young fledgling movements that have built up steam, that are based on good ideas, and he instantly infiltrates and perverts it and usurps it for his own uses.
And isn't that what they did with the John Birch Society almost as soon as it was formed in the 60s or the 50s?
Well, absolutely, and it's not only the John Birch Society, but 1,000 others like it.
Absolutely. So every movement that shows promise, they take it over and they basically implode it.
Well, look at British Israel. Edward Heinz, the banker who started writing history books for British Israel. And the German Saxons went from being a kindred race of the English to being evil Huns that had to be destroyed.
Halt the Hun.
There you have it.
Well, if you want to halt the Hun, you need to throw the Jew banker out.
It was not that Marx immediately introduced himself into the movement. On the contrary, at the meeting in St. Martin's Hall on September 28, 1864, when the Internationale was definitely founded, Marx played no part at all. "I was present," he wrote to Engels, "only as a dumb personage on the platform. But he was named, nevertheless, a member of the subcommittee, the other members being Mazzini's secretary, a Polish Jew named Wolf, Le Lubez, a French Freemason," that's six strikes, "Kremer, the secretary of the English Masons Union," that's nine strikes, "and Weston, the Owenite." What's an Owenite? O-W-E-N-I-T-E.
I don't know, but Kremer is not a typical English name, especially if he's a Freemason, is he?
Kremer, I don't think Kremer is an English or a, that seems to me a variation of Kremer, and I always pretty much accepted, I could be wrong, but I always thought it was pretty much a Jewish.
Oh, is that a reference to Robert Owen and his utopian society?
Probably.
Since I'm Googling Owenite, and it says the most notable organization of Owenites, New Harmony, which they were going to build a utopian society, and I think I remember this from history class when we were studying fringe movements and cults and all these New Age organizations that claimed that they would have a utopia and a communal society. And I think Robert Owen was in the United States, and he built some communal society, free love, all that nonsense, and it didn't go anywhere.
Were the Jesuits one of the fringe movements and cults that you found, that you studied?
We didn't study them as a cult. We studied them as a religious institution.
Oh, I wonder if that had anything to do with the school you went to. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about back in high school we were doing this.
Oh, okay.
I didn't go to a Catholic high school.
I thought you meant college.
Oh, no, in college, if we were talking about cults or anything like that, it would always be in the context of Aryan nations, these haters.
At the first meeting of this committee, Wolf, Jew number one, placed it before the statutes of Mazzini's working men's associations, proposing them as the basis of the new association. He placed before the committee the statutes of Mazzini's working men's associations. That kind of looks like our Congress, right? Well, when something happens, a Jew throws a law down on it, throws a pile of papers that basically is a bill down on a table, right? proposing them as the basis of the new association. Lee Lubez suggested amendments described by Marx as perfectly childish. I was firmly resolved, he wrote, not to leave a single line, if possible, of all their balderdash. In a few weeks, he had succeeded in establishing his authority. My propositions were all accepted by the commission. They only insisted on the introduction in the preamble of the statutes of two phrases on duties and rights and on truth, morality, and justice. I don't know how you could have that on a four-man committee with at least three Jews. But I placed them in such a way that it can do no harm. The provisional statutes of the Internationale, thus amended by Marx, were sent from London to Paris in the following November and accepted by the members of the association. In all of these maneuvers, Marx had again displayed his skill in making use of the ideas of others to serve his own purpose. Just as he has succeeded in appropriating the theories of earlier socialists and passing them off as his own invention, so now he contrived to gain a reputation of having founded the Internationale, an achievement we shall find habitually attributed to him by Marxian writers. But on this point, we have further the conclusive evidence of James Guillaume, a Swiss member of the association and its principal chronicler.
It all goes back to Satan.
Well, yes, it does.
So Marx isn't the author of any of this. The rabbis wrote the Talmud. It was handed to them by Satan, and Marx just took what he knew from the Talmud since he came from a family of rabbis.
Well, that's basically all the Jewish socialists and the Jewish, how do I word this? The Jewish meddlers in our society, that's all they have ever done was seek to implement the Talmud on Christianity. That's all it ever boils down to.
If they were overt and they came right out and said that we're going to establish a Talmudic theocracy, most people who want to be left alone or who don't really care about the Jews would be out in the street saying no Jewish theocracy, no Jewish theocracy, or maybe just no theocracy, no theocracy.
Well, right. Well, a Jewish theocracy is the rule of Satan, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is not true that this is a quote of James Guillaume, the Swiss member of this association.
Uh-huh.
It is not true that the Internationale was the creation of Karl Marx. He remained completely outside the preparatory work that took place from 1862 to 1864. He joined the Internationale at the moment when the initiative of the English and French workmen had just created it. Like the cuckoo, he came and laid his egg in a nest which was not his own. His plan from the first day was to make the great working men's organization the instrument of his personal views. End of quote. But Marx was not the only intriguer to introduce himself into the movement. Monsieur Drumont has admirably described the manner in which middle-class theorists, entirely unsympathetic to the workers, succeeded in capturing the association. Quote, in its origin, the French Internationale was far from being revolutionary. From seeking disturbances in the streets, from liking insurrection for insurrection's sake. The Emperor Napoleon III, the only sovereign since 1789 who had sincerely interested himself in the working classes, who understood their sufferings and desired to improve their lot, had followed the progress of the new association with sympathy. It was only after a time that bourgeois agitators could make the Internationale deviate from its goal. Now, I think bourgeois agitators are actually Jews after the French Revolution, right?
Yes.
This fact is ceaselessly repeated in everything the proletarians attempt. The bourgeois capitalist exploits them as workers. When they deliberate together in order to consider means for improving their lot, the bourgeois revolutionary, that is to say the needy bourgeois who wants to become a capitalist, always finds a way of introducing himself into these associations and of making them serve for the satisfaction of his ambition.
So what she's really saying translates to the Jewish capitalist exploits the worker and pushes him into the arms of the Jewish revolutionary.
Well, that's the way I look at it. And
I've read, too, that those who seek to lead revolutions do not wish to set you free. They wish to become your new master.
Absolutely.
And the only real exception was the American Revolution, and it wasn't led by Jews. If it had been led by Jews, we would have seen, 1960s culture in 1790.
Well, right. The American Revolution was probably actually led on noble principles. It was probably the only revolution of our age that has been led on noble principles. It was through the secret societies that these bourgeois elements found their way into the new association. Friborg himself declared that the Internationale everywhere found support in Freemasonry. Freemasonry, that is to say, in the lodges of the Grand Orient, and M. Lewis Inault records that in March 1865, all the secret associations of Europe and America were merged in the International Association of Working Men, the Marianne, the Frères de la République of Lyons and Marseille, the Fenians of Ireland, the innumerable secret societies of Russia and Poland, the remains of the Carbonari in Italy, joined up with the new society. This fusion was made. The Internationale, though itself an open and avowed association, thus became, through its absorption of these existing secret organizations, a huge semi-secret society. That is to say, it formed the outer shell that covered a ramification of conspiracies alien to the ideas of its founders, and of which the secrets were known only to its middle-class directors. The anti-religious policy adopted by the Internationale was the work of these secret influences. In the same year of 1865, a great Students' Congress took place in Liege, at which Fontaine declared, quote, "What we wish for, we revolutionaries and socialists, is physical, moral, and intellectual development of the human race. Note that I say physical first, intellectual afterwards. We wish, in the moral order, by the annihilation of all prejudices of religion and the church, to arrive at the negation of God and at free examination." Whenever you see people, whenever you see a movement take God out of the world, you know there's Jews behind it, right?
Absolutely, and I think this would be a good time for me to read the lyrics of the song, Le Internationale. Would you like the British version?
Well, a version that we can understand.
All right. "Arise, ye workers, from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstitions, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks and fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, then they soon shall hear the bullets flying. We'll shoot the generals on our own side. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No savior from on high delivers. No faith have we in prince or peer. Our own right hand the chains must shiver, chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Ere the thieves will out with their booty, and to all give a happier lot, each at his forge must do their duty, and will strike the iron while it's hot. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race." And in some they say the Internationale shall become the human race.
Yeah, I got to get that on my Mein Kampf site, because that's an excellent example of Jewish anti-Christian propaganda.
And I actually have footage, I have, if you want, of the Scottish Socialist Party standing up and singing the Internationale before one of their meetings.
And nothing could be more destructive to the human race than the amalgamation of the human race into one brown clod.
So
right?
They're not really for diversity then, are they? They're for all of us becoming some Obama or Tiger Woods. They want everybody to look like Barack Obama or Tiger Woods or some variation.
Well, diversity is an impossibility. You can't mix diverse ingredients into the same bowl and recognize the original form of any ingredient.
But, you know, the world was diverse 200 years ago.
Yes.
Now the world's just becoming carbon copy.
Well, right. It's diversity is an oxymoron. And when discussed of a nation or of a
mongrelized
culture, you can't have a diverse culture. You can't have a diverse nation. They're oxymorons. Those things cannot exist.
You need segregation to preserve diversity.
Yes, you do.
If you want to see, you know, German culture, you go to Germany. If you want to see what the Somalians call Somali culture, and you don't mind, you know, taking your life in your own hands, you go to Somalia.
Well, right, you don't mind eating your neighbor. Barbecue spit.
Well, you know, the Somalians, they're all from the exact same ethnic group. They are all from the, what are they called, the Somali group. So they divided into clans, so they could still have a reason to war each other. That's just how primitive and reckless and violent they are. They had to subdivide into clans based on geography, despite the fact that they all are the same ethnicity. They're all Somalian ethnicity.
Well, the bottom line is whenever you see anybody preaching the brotherhood of man, you know that if he's not a Jew, there's one standing behind him whispering in his ear.
Since there is no brotherhood of man.
No, it's not possible. That's something that doesn't exist. And Lafargue, after chanting the praises of our Grand Master Proudhon, at a further sitting of the Congress held in Brussels, had ended with the cry, "War on God, hatred towards God. That is progress. We must shatter heaven like a vault of a paper." Now, how do you read this? How does any Christian? Well, that's the problem, is that Christians don't read this, right? That's the big problem. How do you read this? You read that these people were Jews. You read that they usurped this new trade union movement in Europe. They entirely usurped it. Three of the four committee members are Jews, or four of the five. I didn't count them. And we find them shouting war on God and hatred towards God. And Christians continue to embrace these Jews. How do you read this and not know that the only goal of the Jew in society is to destroy it through the destruction of the idea of God and morality in society?
Absolutely. And I'd like to read a quote from Through 30 Years by Henry Wickham Steed. Is that all right?
Sure.
Page 30. "Moreover, to those who believed in Marx, socialism offered a substitute for religion. At a time when the old philosophies were losing their hold and the churches were reeling under the blows of scientific criticism, the Marxist doctrine, with its materialist conception of the universe, its economic syllogisms, and its promise of a better life to be attained through the socialist state, seemed to fill, with grounds for positive faith, a void of which many Germans had been vaguely conscious. It mattered little that these grounds for faith were not entirely new. They acquired convincing force from the uncompromising vehemence with which Marx stated half-truths as whole-truths. Mere arguments rarely move the masses. Ideas that are put forward with all the qualifications requisite for approximate accuracy have little drive and cannot sway men's minds. Marx and his disciples propounded a set of dogmas, created emotions about them, and in reality founded a materialist economic church. These dogmas were drawn from a materialistic conception of the world and of history. Marx taught that the economic order is the basis of all social order, and that the legal and political structures of society, as well as religion and philosophy, are explicable only in the light of economic conditions."
But isn't that exactly what we've seen in the United States after World War II?
Absolutely.
The exact same thing has happened in this country.
Economics mean everything.
Every decision in life is an economic decision. And they love to form databases to track our economic decisions. Coke.
Crime happens because of poverty.
Coke, Pepsi, Coke, Pepsi. They got the whole world reduced to Coke or Pepsi.
All right.
That's all people should care about. Oh, I drink Coke. Oh, I drink Pepsi. Well, we can't talk. Go be scram.
All social or political change, he contended, is the result of antecedent economic change. He left no place for the influence of generous ideas or for the ideas of justice or liberty. In words which I afterwards heard his son-in-law, Paul Lafauger, use in public, quote, "Marx turned God out of history," quote. And that's through the book Through 30 Years, page 30, by Henry Wickham Steed.
Marx was only doing what the Talmud taught him to do.
Wage war against God.
Absolutely. Elimination of God is the elimination for any reason for morality in society. We become a completely immoral, they might want to call it amoral, but it's immoral.
They say it's the absence of morality. I say it's not only the absence of morality, it's the presence of immorality.
Well, right. There's no, you can't have a world without a God, and they become their own God, and they don't, that they admit that to themselves, but they really don't want to admit it to the goyim.
And
they don't
Christ.
Want that. They don't want these idiots in these Judeo-Christian churches to know that the Jews really believe that they are God.
And
that,
I
might,
had a,
that might set people off, but that's the truth.
I had a Jew tell me that we have no need of your Jesus. The Kohenim are the messiahs for the Jewish people.
Right. They're their own messiah, and they're their own God. And they sincerely believe that.
That's pretty candid. That's a candid admission from a Jew, isn't it?
Right. And there's no Satan in Judaism because they are Satan.
They never talk about the battle of good versus evil, do they? They just talk about making as much money as you can, material gains, and then dying and becoming worm food.
Well, absolutely. There is no battle of good and evil. There might be good investments and bad investments. There might be good loans and bad loans.
Well, if you ask a Jew what do they think of the afterlife, no Jew has any concept of an afterlife, do they?
No, and neither do they have hope in one.
Because they know if it exists, it's going to be a lot warmer than Miami.
And Lafargue, after chanting the praises of our Grandmaster Proudhon, and he was one of those social theorists in the 1848 revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at a further sitting of the Congress held in Brussels, had ended with the cry, "War on God, hatred towards God, that is progress. We must shatter heaven like a vault of paper." A number of these men, proudly claimed by the Freemasons as members of their order, crowded into the Internationale, which thus became permeated with the spirit of Illuminism. At a meeting of the Association, Garibaldi, venturing to propose that faith in God should be adopted by the Congress, met with a stony silence, and was obliged to qualify the suggestion with the explanation that by the religion of God he meant the religion of reason, the worship of the goddess of reason. He added later, such as was practiced in the French Revolution.
I'm sure he just added that to save his skin.
Yes, that's what it sounds like. The working men took no part in these blasphemies. When Jacquard declared to the outside atheism that outside atheism there was no hope for man, to be religious is to be ridiculous, Fribourg, the bronze worker, Chaudy and Lemonnier combated these views in the name of liberal Paris and of liberal France. For, as the authority of the secret history truly adds, these are not so much the views of working men as of professors and philosophers, and we know who they are. Indeed, the vine growers of Neuchâtel, so little understood, I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, Neuchâtel, okay, so little understood the aims of the Internationale as to declare naively that the principal article of their branch of the association should be, quote, every vine dresser must have a Bible and not neglect divine service, as the suggestion received with derision by their middle-class directors. It is difficult to write of these things calmly, for to deceive the people whose simple faith and lack of education prevent them from seeing whither they are being led is as cowardly as to guide a blind man into a ditch. Isn't that what Christ accused the Pharisees of doing all the time?
He said that when the blind lead the blind, both go to the ditch, and the Pharisees are shutting up the kingdom of heaven against all because they're not going in, and they know it, and they don't want to suffer anybody else to go in.
And people still follow the Pharisees.
Isn't that what the Jews are doing in this country? They're doing in the world today. They know that they have no place in the afterlife, so they're trying to take as many people in the hell with them.
Well, that's been going on for 7,000 years.
Aren't we told misery loves company?
Yet this is what the exploiters of the Internationale did for the working men. The identity of these middle-class interlopers who assembled at the Second Congress of the association in Lausanne in 1867 has thus been given by the author of The Secret History. Quote, one delegate from Belgium, six delegates from England, 17 from France, six from Germany, two from Italy, and 31 from Switzerland, wow, came together in a room of the casino at Lausanne. Three only of the deputies from England were of English name. England was mainly represented by two German tailors and a French fiddle maker. Germany was represented by two doctors, one professor, a hotel keeper, a machinist, and a gentleman of no profession that he cared to name. What was that, Marx? Italy was represented by two doctors, Stanfa and Tomasi, four professors, three journalists, and a commercial agent represented the toilers of Zurich and Geneva. Now this is a working laborers association, supposedly, right?
So I'm sure they have no common ground with Marx. If people are sitting around and they're complaining about conditions at work, what could Marx say? That room service is pretty bad in the hotel he's staying at?
Well, right, but the point is that all these people are professionals, and that there's one machinist in the group, and there's two tailors and a French fiddle maker. That they're working men, but a professor, a hotel keeper, a gentleman of no profession, a commercial agent, and from Italy, four other professors and three journalists.
So the gentleman of no profession, it's either got to be Marx or Bakunin.
Well, right, and the rest of them are from the literati, the journalists, the professors. Who are they? That they're not even Europeans, never mind working men.
And saying a gentleman of no profession, that's being rather polite. They could have just said a vagrant.
Observe that here is not a gathering of the craftsmen bent on study of the questions which affect them in their hours of work and in their rate of pay, but an assembly of middle-class dreamers and theorists. The English, quote-unquote, deputies here referred to are further described by James Guillaume. The tailor Icarius, friend and disciple of Marx, was a long personage with an unkempt beard, hair falling carelessly over his eyes, always stuffing his nose with tobacco. The other German tailor, Lessner, was the true type of bearded Democrat with burning eyes. His role seemed to be protest perpetually. So they had Jews at this gathering.
And don't they have people like that today, the ARA types that protest perpetually? Whenever they need a mob, they just call up the local ARA club at whatever college it happens to be somewhere in the county, and they say, be at place so-and-so at time so-and-so.
Well, right, and they're usually kids from social studies departments that never plan on working.
You ask them what they want to do when they grow up, and they can't give you an answer. All they do is they spout ideology. Well, that's not a career.
During discussion, Icarius speaks slowly with an imperturbable phlegm. Lessner cannot contain himself and exhales his passionate soul in a torrent of violent and bitter words. Before an unintelligent contradictor, Icarius shrugs his shoulders. Lessner bounds about and seems to wish to devour his adversary. Sounds like the Jews Peter was talking about. Eugene Dupont, the Frenchman and future president of the Congress, belonged to a quite different type, a young man of 30 resembling all young men with a mustache. I remark in him, adds Guillaume, nothing but an innocent fondness for punning. Another London member, this time an Englishman, not present at this Congress, was an eccentric millionaire named Cowell Stepney, deaf as a post, an enthusiastic communist, and a member of the General Council. The International Association of Working Men had become a farce. In vain, the real workmen from Paris had protested at the first Congress in Geneva against the invasion of their ranks by men who were not manual workers, declaring that if the Workers' Congress were to be composed in greater part by economists, journalists, lawyers, and employers, the thing would be ridiculous and would annihilate the association. Marx,
the whole idea of a transnational united communist front is ridiculous. My dad and I were discussing earlier today that the British Communist Party opposed Britain's entry into World War II due to the German-Soviet non-aggression pact Then after, and they protested against the war for the first 2 years. Then when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, they vigorously threw their support behind the war, and they advocated a position of unconditional surrender or destroy Germany as the two options Germany should be given.
Well, it shows that they were just puppets for Stalin all along, right?
Exactly, and I pointed out to my dad that in the 20s, Lenin in Moscow fired the head of the German Communist Party, and I said it was clearly just the German branch of the Soviet Communist Party if the German communist can be fired by Lenin.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure he wasn't a German anyway. He was a Jew in Germany who took his marching orders from Moscow.
Marx, who in his preamble of the Provisional Rules of the Internationale had declared himself that, quote, the emancipation of the working classes must be brought about by the working classes themselves, waxed indignant at what he described as the maneuver of Tulane and Friedborg in invoking the principle that only working men can represent working men, and the French workmen's motion was defeated by 25 votes to 20. Marx did indeed not conceal his contempt for the originators of the Internationale. The working men, particularly those from Paris, he wrote a month after the Congress to his young Jewish friend, Dr. Kugelman, belong as luxury workers, i.e. engravers on bronze, no doubt strongly to the old filth, dem alten dreck angehoren. Ignorant, vain, pretentious, garrulous, swollen with pomposity, they were on the point of spoiling everything. Having rushed to the Congress in numbers which in no way correspond to that of their adherents, in the report I shall clandestinely wrap them over the knuckles. Marx is bragging about his conquering of the working men in their own association, basically. As M. Guillaume, Monsieur Guillaume, truly observes, all Marx is already in this letter. The English delegates fared no better at his hands, for in the following year we find him writing this in this strain to Engels, quote, I shall personally go to the next Congress at Brussels so as to give the coup de grace to those asses of Proudhonians in the official report of the General Council, for in spite of their efforts, the Parisian chatterboxes, meaning the real working men, have not been able to prevent our re-election. I shall give them the stick. The swine hounds amongst the English trade unionists who thought we were going too far will not catch us up easily. Things are advancing, and at the first revolution, which is perhaps nearer than it seems, that is to say, you and I will have this powerful instrument in our hands, we can really be well satisfied. And we see that Marx, you know, if you remember the Communist Manifesto was written, he was ordered to write that by the secret societies that pulled off the 1848 revolution.
And he was ordered to write it and have it ready ahead of time.
Right. And so, here he is, and he's probably basically being ordered to infiltrate this Working Men's Association, and it's the secret societies behind the scenes that are pulling his strings here. I would say it would be pretty safe to assume. In the light of these passages, it is amusing to find one of Marx's admirers explaining that the essence of Marxian socialism is that the working classes must themselves work out their own salvation. So why do we need Marx, right? It was, moreover, not only the industrial proletariat of France that Marx despised, but also those dwellers in the country districts who remain contentedly at work on their own bit of land, an arrangement, of course, directly opposed to the principles of communism. And this is a precursor for the Bolshevik Revolution, right?
Absolutely.
Because they revolted, they led this revolution in the name of the working proletariat, and as soon as they got to power, what did they do to the working men and the proletariat?
Starved most of them to death.
Starved them to death, and
they said that the bourgeois oppress you. As soon as they got in, they took 80 or 90% of whatever these people were producing. They just took it away.
Absolutely.
Would you like me to take it from here for a while?
Sure. My voice is getting hoarse already.
The Bonapartes, he had written contemptuously, after 1852, are the dynasty of the peasants, that is to say, of the mass of the French nation. This dynasty, he goes on to point out, is therefore represented not by the revolutionary peasant, quote, who wishes to overthrow the old order, quote, but by the conservative peasant who, stupidly, bound by the old order, wishes to see himself saved and protected with his portion of the soil under the shadow of the empire, end quote. What that translates to is the poor working man who just wants to be left alone on his small farm.
Well, right, and it's the same thing that's going on today. The Jews despise the white middle, well, they call them middle class, but they're really not. The white craftsmen and laborers who earn their money and work with their hands, the Jews hate those people, and they'll never leave them alone.
And these people don't want to rise up and start cutting throats of big business owners or killing managers. They just want maybe a few extra days vacation, or they want a slightly better wage, or they want taxes decreased so they're not being crushed under the burden of taxation to pay for Shakima's 12 welfare babies.
But they're the same people that every Sunday sit in church and hear, the Jews are God's chosen people, and we have to be nice to the Negroes because they're poor and downtrodden and oppressed. And they believe it.
But they're well-meaning and they're well-intentioned.
They're the salt of the earth, but they're totally deceived.
Exactly. Well, I mean, look at Eve. She was more than just the salt of the earth, and even she was deceived. It happens again and again and again to our people. Every great civilization we build up, they subvert.
Well, Christians should never embrace the Jews. We've seen the patterns over and over again in history, and Christians still embrace the Jews because they don't learn from history.
When we were talking about Adam Smith and free markets, the Jew will take the free market and use the tools inherent in the free market system to turn it into an unfree market.
Right, to monopolize it.
And the Jews will take the tools and freedoms inherent in a republic, and he'll turn it into something different from a republic, either a socialist state, a degenerated democracy, mob rule, anarchy. He'll turn it into something other than a constitutional republic.
Well, we'd have had a lot more problems in this country probably in the 20th century if we had not had the Federal Reserve, but we'd have been a lot better off for it. The Federal Reserve, all free market, free enterprise, ended in this country in 1913 when the Jews got a monopoly on the creation of money.
Absolutely. If then it was the prosperity of the French peasants that roused Marx's ire, we might at least expect him to extend some sympathy towards the poor and destitute amongst the working classes. Not at all. This portion of the people is designated by him as the lumpen proletariat, that is to say, the ragged proletariat, for which, as Bakunin pointed out with indignation, quote, Marx, Engels, and all the school of social democrats of Germany display a profound contempt, end quote. What section of the proletariat, then, did Marx approve? Obviously, the section that showed itself submissive to his dictates. The respective attitudes of Marx and of Bakunin towards the people much resembled those of Robespierre and Marat, their predecessors in the rival schools of state socialism and anarchy. To Robespierre, the people whose sovereignty, he proclaimed, consisted simply of his own following amongst the men, and more particularly the women, of the Paris Faubourgs. To Marx, the proletariat, whose dictatorship he advocated, was represented by the small number of working men who showed themselves willing to play into the hands of their German and Jewish exploiters. And I think that translates to Jews in Germany, since I don't think there were enough Germans to fill a horse carriage.
Absolutely.
But both to Marat and to Bakunin, the people meant merely the turbulent element amongst the populace, wastrels, criminals, drunkards, thieves, and vagabonds. Bakunin, proposing his favorite toast, to the destruction of all law and order and the unchaining of evil passions. Here we go, the unchaining of Satan.
Well, there we
have it. Handed to the beast.
And he's supposed to be a Slav, and I don't know, but he sure as hell doesn't act like a Slav.
He went to the army.
Nobleman.
He went to the army academy, though, and Jews probably wouldn't go to an army academy, would they?
No, and he's a Slavic nobleman with a completely Jewish mind, it seems like.
Maybe he's an eighth or a quarter. Might well have been the soul of the Spanish dwarf reincarnated in the body of the Russian giant. For criminals, he expressed his predilection quite frankly. Quote, Only the proletariat, in rags, is inspired by the spirit and force of the coming social revolution, and in no way the bourgeois stratum of the working masses. Quote, his hopes, even in the mujiks of Russia, were disappointed, owing to the patriarchal conditions of their lives and their respect for the emperor, so that it is to the brigands that he looks for salvation. And generally, didn't we cover that when we got into William Guy Carr, how they rely heavily on criminals and thugs and people that have a history of murder and the most vile atrocities?
Well, that's who they used to get the Bolshevik Revolution going. And then, that's, you know, even if you look in the Book of Acts, the Jews in Thessalonica that wanted to start trouble against the Christians, what does Luke say in Acts? They went to the markets and they got the scum of society from the markets to attack Paul. It's the same pattern that they've always pulled. Go enlist the scum of society. They're cheap. They can be bought easily, and they'll do everything you want.
And if they get killed, it doesn't matter.
Look at Sacco and Vanzetti. Look at all the anarchist movements and enlisted the scum of society, the criminals, the people in the dregs of the cities, and that they've taken advantage of those people.
And I'm sure that's why the Democrats want all these people to have the vote in this country so they can go vote for Obama.
Well, look at all the Negro riots that the Jews have taken great advantage of for political spin in this country.
Absolutely.
It's the same pattern over and over again.
The only
fails. We just fail to see it.
And none of them work. They don't contribute in any substantive way, do they?
No, Gerald, absolutely not.
Gerald told me he was watching, I think, TV once back in the 70s, early 70s, maybe late 60s, and the reporters at 2 p.m. were asking Governor Wallace, who was campaigning, where are your supporters? Since there were only two or three people out there at 2 p.m. holding Wallace signs, and there were thousands of people protesting, and Wallace just said, my supporters are at work.
Right.
So that's why at any time in the day, some Jew snaps their fingers, they can get 10,000 blacks and Mexicans in the street. It doesn't matter if it's 10 a.m. and 90% of normal people are at work. You'll get 10,000 Mexicans in the street and shut down traffic because they're just sitting in their homes. I should say they're sitting in their subsidized homes.
They're sitting in their, yeah, right. 40 of them to an apartment.
All right. The only man who in the midst of the Russian people has the audacity to revolt against the commune is the brigand. Thence, brigandage constitutes an important phenomenon in the history of the Russian people. The first revolutionaries of Russia, Pugachev and Stenka Razin, were brigands. Robbery, Bakunin writes again, is one of the most honorable forms of Russian national life. The brigand is the hero, the defender, the popular avenger, the irreconcilable enemy of the state and of all social and civil order established by the state. He is the wrestler in life and in death against all this civilization of officials, of nobles, of priests, and of the crown. And isn't that what we see in this country today? They praise criminals.
All the time. That they praise criminals. The liberal constantly lobby society to lighten penalties for criminals because it's not their fault.
Or
they were oppressed when they were born. They were oppressed when they went through life.
They always make excuses for them.
Right, all the time.
Or they'll say, oh, certainly we don't condone their crimes, but then they offer them $1 million to tell their story on CNN or write a book or make a movie about them. And that's a form of praising them. They give them celebrity status. This Negro in Connecticut that blew away almost a dozen people, his girlfriend is now going around, this white hoe, saying that he was oppressed and he was the victim of racism, but they have him on tape stealing beer from the beer distribution company that he worked at.
Look at that faggot, Truman Capote. That I remember this case from the 70s. I don't remember all the details, but that faggot, Truman Capote, lobbied and lobbied and lobbied to get this idiot out of prison that was a madman and a murderer who wrote a book called In the Belly of the Beast. He got him sprung from prison, and what does the guy do? He stabs somebody else to death.
Well, what did he expect?
Well, they should have put Truman Capote and all the other Jews that lobbied to get him out of prison. They should have put them all in a cell with him.
He's just a victim of society.
Right.
Since society infringes his freedom to stab someone. In all this, Bakunin showed himself a true and faithful follower of Weishaupt. Was the robber baron of Dago perhaps an Illuminatus too? And it is here that we find the explanation of his creed. Until the dawn of Illuminism, crime and virtue, good and evil, held their opposing positions in the conceptions of the human mind. And the Jews are infamous moral relativists, aren't they? Oh, is that really right? Is that really wrong? Who's to say? Even in pagan Greek, Kirkun and Procustes found no apologists, but ranked simply as monsters of whom it was necessary to rid the world. It was left to Weishaupt to confuse the issues, to glorify by the name of useful larceny what had hitherto been described by the ugly name of theft, and to Brissot, the adept of Illuminized Freemasonry, to declare theft to be a virtue. And it was Weishaupt who had first set out to destroy that religion and civilization which Bakunin and the Baron von Sternberg alike detested. And they've always been working to weaken our morals and make it so, oh, is it really clear? Is this person really a criminal? Maybe not. He's just the victim of the state, the victim of society. Society forced him to take advantage of those girls. Society forced him to do this. As Bezmenov said in the KGB method of destabilizing and demoralizing a nation, they make it appear that law enforcement, law and order, the police are all pigs, nasty, corrupt, and criminals are all portrayed as Robin Hood.
Well, that goes right in hand with that Frankfurt School teaching concerning the authoritarian male, which was basically a blatant frontal attack on white society and the rule of law.
Well, now we hear some, 50-year-old rabbi, when they catch him with an 8-year-old girl, he says, oh, she seduced me. And people say, oh, that's so bad. The rabbi's going to have his career ruined because that girl came on to him. An 8-year-old girl doesn't seduce anybody. That's ridiculous.
Well, look at this perverted Jew that they arrested in Europe because he's been on Roman Polanski, that they wanted him for raping a 12 or 13-year-old here in America, and the Jews were up in arms. The Jews were very vocal against his arrest in Europe and deportation to America, so they found some excuse not to extradite him, and they just let him go.
They were saying it happened so long ago, don't ruin his life for something that was 30 years old. Well, John Demoniak here in Ohio supposedly was a guard at some camp in 1941. He's in a wheelchair in his 80s, and that didn't stop them from saying send him back to Germany.
Right. And somebody brought up a good point to me last week. How come there's 6 million Holocaust survivors still in the world, and they can only find one Nazi, and he's an 80-year-old man in a wheelchair?
And they had to come to Ohio to find him.
The hypocrisy of the Jew is blatant. It's constantly right in our faces, and it's never ending.
And, first they said that he was Ivan the Terrible at Treblinka, or Sobibor, and he was sentenced to death in Israel. The Israeli Supreme Court threw out the sentence and released him, saying that there was a terrible mistake made, and they didn't want to put an innocent man to death. So then he came back to the U.S., back to Ohio. And then they started to say again, oh, you weren't Ivan the Terrible from Treblinka, but you're Ivan the Horrible from Sobibor. So they're intent on proving he was someone somewhere. And if he wasn't at Sobibor, well, you were at Bergen-Belsen. Oh, you weren't at Bergen-Belsen. Oh, so-and-so remembers you from Dachau. And it's just going to continue on until they've ruined him or caused him a heart attack.
Right. They're just hypocrites. That's all they are, is hypocrites.
But,
they do everything for their own selfish reasons, and we have to learn to that the Jews are Satan, and we have to separate ourselves from them, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Christians aren't going to learn that until it's too late. I really think that most Christians are going to be mad at God for destroying the tares and say, "How dare you do that to your chosen people?"
Yeah, how dare you, God? Who are you to do that? They're supposed to be your chosen people, and the Jews want to bury this old man for something that may have happened 70 years ago, but something that Polanski did 30 years ago and has probably been doing ever since when he was over in France. I said, oh, it's 30 years ago. Let him go. He's learned his lesson. Don't ruin his life. All right. Bakunin, then, must not be regarded as a solitary demoniac, but as an exponent of those doctrines of Illuminism which found a fruitful soil in his wild Russian nature. On this point, we have definite evidence for the socialist Milan, who was a member of the Internationale, excuse me, and personally acquainted with the Russian anarchist, has explicitly stated that, quote, Bakunin was a disciple of Weishaupt, end quote. It is only necessary to study the writings of Bakunin in order to recognize the truth of this statement. Moreover, in the same year of 1864 that the Internationale was founded, Bakunin and his disciple Nechiev started a society on precisely the lines of the Illuminati. The plan of such conspirators had always been to envelop one secret society in another on the system of a nest of Chinese boxes, the outer one large and visible, the inner ones dwindling down to the tiny, almost invisible cell that contains the secret. This was the plan of Weishaupt, affected by his grades of adepts, initiated by successive stages into the greater and the lesser mysteries. And this, too, was the plan of Bakunin and his confederate, Nechiev. The society organized by them consisted of three orders. One, the International Brothers. Two, the National Brothers. And three, the International Alliance of Social Democracy, which in its turn covered the inter-secret society called the Fraternal Alliance, over which Bakunin exercised supreme control. Wasn't he supposed to be an anarchist?
Yes, he was.
So, if he's an anarchist, how can he have this supreme control over this well-coordinated...
Because he's a hypocrite. Because they're all hypocrites.
All right.
He's an anarchist. Anarchists really want to rule themselves. That they want to destroy all opposition so that they could rule.
They
want
to
destroy. Anarchy, the idea of anarchy, is just a sham.
Exactly. Anarchy is always intended as a transition from a republic or a monarchy run by whites for white interests
to a
Jewish communist state.
Right.
Anarchy is just a period in between. They bring order out of the chaos, which, incidentally, they cause the chaos.
Yes.
We have only to compare the program of the International Social Democratic Alliance with the plan of Weishaupt to recognize the evident connection between the two. Placed in parallel columns, the aims of both will be seen to be identical. Weishaupt, the order of the Illuminati, abjured Christianity. In the lodges, death was declared an eternal sleep. Patriotism and loyalty were called narrow-minded prejudices, incompatible with universal benevolence. Have Jews ever been for universal benevolence?
No, they're loyal to their own God, which is themselves, and that's their only loyalty. And no. They are basically they have no morals that are based. Well, they have no personal morals whatsoever, and they have no moral. Well, let me say that the outside groups have no moral standing with Jews. Let me put it that way: the Jews have no moral obligations to any outside group. They could lie, steal, cheat. Their own religion approves of all that in order that they could get what they want from you.
As
that's
long as they don't
their
do it
religion.
To anybody in the club.
That's in the Talmud. That's in the Kal Nidre, where they disavow their oaths ahead of time every year.
My oath shall be no oaths, my word shall be no word.
Right. So really, the religion of the Jew, it is the that Jewry is the world's oldest crime ring, and their religion legitimizes their crime ring.
Exactly, and there are now gangs of Orthodox Jews in their Orthodox garb going around in Israel and the West Bank beating up Palestinian men that approach Jewish women. How is that universal benevolence and doing away with narrow-minded prejudice?
Well, right. The Jews can be racist in Palestine, but nobody else can be racist outside of Palestine. And I actually have a post. I have a video of that and of a news item concerning that posted in the Christigenia Forum.
They accounted all princes, usurpers, and tyrants, and all privileged orders as their abettors. They meant to abolish the laws which protected property accumulated by long-continued and successful industry, and to prevent for the future any such accumulation, except for themselves, of course. They intended to establish universal liberty and equality, the imprescriptible rights of man, and as preparation for this, they intended to root out all religion and ordinary morality, and even to break the bonds of domestic life by destroying the veneration for marriage vows and by taking the education of children out of the hands of the parents.
That's the Communist Manifesto by Weishaupt, 75 years before Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto.
Absolutely, and we've seen in Russia number one, when they got the chance, they implemented that. They nationalized women and tried to nationalize children. That sounds like something straight out of the mind of Satan.
They basically nationalized children in this country through child protection agencies.
If your kid's playing in the woods and he gets a scratch on his face, your kid's getting taken away. We'll put him with
it's a lot more than that. It's you will raise your children the way we say. And if we don't approve it, we'll take your children. That's what child protection agencies are really all about. That's what the public school system's all about.
If you don't want your children learning about the Holocaust and Martin Luther King, well, you're not fit to have these children. Then Bakunin, the Alliance professes atheism. It aims at the abolition of religious services, the replacement of belief by knowledge and divine by human justice, the abolition of marriage as a political, religious, and civic arrangement. Before all, it aims at the definite and complete abolition of all classes and the political, economic, and social equality of the individual of either sex, the abolition of inheritance, all children to be brought up on a uniform system so that artificial inequalities may disappear.
Some anarchist, huh?
What does that mean? If one child reads faster and he can get his homework done a day ahead of all the other students, what, they should hit him in the head so he has a concussion now and he has to read slower?
No, this is George Bush's No Child Left Behind, right? But it's 150 years before George Bush. It shows that even George Bush is a communist. There's no doubt. I mean, Republican,
exactly.
Democrat, neocon, Bolshevik, it don't matter. Well, they are all Talmudic, satanic Marxists.
And for the idea of no child left behind, if the child doesn't want to be left behind, he needs to pick up the book and start reading. Or if you're in a race and you don't want to be left behind, you better start running faster. But what they want to do is they want to slow everybody else down, don't they?
Well, absolutely. So we all cross the finish line at the same time. We all have to be as dumb as the dumbest Negro. And that's pretty damn dumb.
That's why you see white people with their hats on sideways and backwards and their pants hanging down to their knees.
Right, so that no child is left behind.
It aims directly at the triumph of the cause of labor over capital. It repudiates so-called patriotism and the rivalry of nations and desires the universal association of all local associations by means of freedom. The final aim of this society was, quote, to accelerate the universal revolution, end quote. You know, I've never seen a communist uprising in Israel, have you?
Never, and there won't be one.
They don't want one. They don't need one.
Absolutely not.
The commissars don't want a Bolshevik revolution in their own backyard.
So we see, we could say Weishaupt wrote the Communist Manifesto, but we can't because we know that the Communist Manifesto is it's all in the Talmud. It's the destruction of Christendom. It's the destruction of Western civilization. It's the destruction of the children of God by the children of the devil.
All right, and I think
they couldn't do it from the outside in. They tried like hell, so they did it from the inside out. But it's our fault. We as a people, when we embrace the enemies of God, when we embrace their ways, we're told how many times in the Old Testament not to follow their ways. We're told in the New Testament, if they're not Christians, don't have anything to do with them. Well, we had everything to do with them, and now look what's happened.
They have our entire society, our entire country, lock, stock, and barrel. They have all the property, they have all our daughters, they have everything.
Right.
So they don't need a Bolshevik revolution in America, since we basically gave up without a shot being fired.
And so did England.
So they basically convinced the generation from, say, the 1920s to the 1970s or 80s to voluntarily put the chains on themselves.
In the name of freedom. It's incredible.
So the greatest generation defended freedom by destroying the only country that ever stood up to communism, going over to Europe and destroying the only government that ever stood up to communism, and then handing over half of Europe to Stalin and China to Mao Zedong. But they're the greatest generation for defending freedom.
Well, yes, they are. They signed right on with the devil, and now in the devil's media, they're the greatest generation. in the Book of Life, I don't think many of those people have a very high standing. There's half a page left to this chapter, isn't there?
All right. Now, how is it possible to suppose that the extraordinary similarity between these two programs can be due to mere coincidence? In the Alliance of Bakunin, as in the Communist Manifesto of Marx, we find again all the points of Weishaupt: abolition of property, inheritance, marriage, and all morality, of patriotism and all religion. Is it not obvious that the plan had been handed down to the succeeding groups of socialists and anarchists by the secret societies which had carried on the traditions of the Illuminati, or we should say the traditions of the rabbis? And that Bakunin, and still more, his coadjutor, Nietzscheev, was simply an Illuminatus. Nietzscheev, moreover, am I butchering that name?
Probably, but that's Nechayev. Nechayev is fine. I'm wrong, there's about six pages left to this chapter. We should probably continue and finish it.
All right. Nechayev, moreover, is a type of no small importance to the history of social revolution. Uninspired by such anarchic philosophy as that proclaimed by Weishaupt and Bakunin, Nechayev showed himself a pure destructionist whose ferocity was untempered by the genial moods of Bakunin. Quote, he was a liar, a thief, and a murderer, the incarnation of hatred, malice, and revenge, who stopped at no crime against friend or foe that promised to advance what he was pleased to call the revolution, end quote. Sounds like a Jew.
Well, absolutely, but I don't know that for sure, and I'm trying to find out.
In the Revolutionary Catechism, he composed in conjunction with Bakunin, the following passages occur. The revolutionary must let nothing stand between him and the work of destruction. For him exists only one single pleasure, one single consolation, one reward, one satisfaction, the success of the revolution. Night and day, he must have but one thought, but one aim, implacable destruction. If he continues to live in this world, it is only in order to annihilate it all the more surely. Well, I mean, that's the Jewish mentality right there, live in this world to destroy the world.
Absolutely.
And the Jew wants to destroy this world, doesn't he?
Well, that's always been Satan's goal, has it not? Doesn't Satan rebel against the creation of Yahweh? That's what Satan does. The Jew daily proves to the world that he is Satan, and Christians are just too blind to see it.
What was it, Hitler?
And that's a result of Christian sin and the Christians accepting of sin. If the Christian would read his Bible and believe it, he would not be able to accept the sin.
And it's in Mein Kampf, isn't it? Should the Jew, with the aid of his Marxist creed, triumph over the people of this world, his crown will be the funeral wreath of mankind, and this planet will once again follow its orbit through ether without any human life on its surface.
Hitler definitely talks about the destruction of all society with the domination of the Jew over society.
And he said, in standing guard against the Jew, I am defending the handiwork of the Lord.
Yes, he did. Hitler was a Christian, a God-fearing Christian that believed that he had to prevent the Jewish destruction of Western civilization.
And that's why the U.S. had to go over there and destroy his society, because it couldn't be allowed to stand. The Jew.
Yes, it is, because we're the whores for Satan. And anybody who wants to take an honest Christian look at American history, the last 150 years, we have been Satan's biggest whore.
I mean, can you think of one war we fought in the last 100 years that we should have fought?
There's not any. We haven't fought a war that we could legitimately defend fighting since the Indian Wars and perhaps the War of 1812.
I mean, I can think of a number of wars that
were set up.
I can think of a number of wars where we should have fought, where we didn't. We should have helped South Africa. We should have helped the Portuguese in Angola, the Belgians in the Congo, the Rhodesians. But instead, we threw sanctions against them and worked to undermine them. We called them.
We've always been on the communist side. We've always been on the Jewish communist side. Ever since we let the Jews have full control over our economy, 1913.
As Douglas Reed said, that we took a verbal stance against communism, but after fighting two great wars, World War I and World War II, supposedly to save freedom and safeguard democracy, we expanded the role of communism in the world.
Well, absolutely. Communism's done nothing but expand under American American stewardship. I have to call it stewardship. It's not involvement, it's stewardship. We've been the stewards of communism. We helped Russia get to where they are. We helped China get to where they are.
Well,
we've done more to advance communism than Russia or China.
But they say we lost China to Mao and the communists. No, we handed it over.
Yes, we did hand it over. We were in a position to stop it. And basically, since Nixon in 1972, we've embraced China, and we favored China, communist China. We've built China. We did it. Well, we didn't stop our politicians from allowing the Jews to loot and pillage this nation and send it all to China.
You know,
in fact, we assisted our politicians by going to Walmart and buying all the crap.
You know, Bezmenov said that we would have to force our politicians to stop propping up communism with grain shipments to the Soviets and trade deals with China. And he said very candidly and explicitly, I am not talking about protests and letters. I am talking about forcing them to stop.
Well, right, because the wolves are in charge of the hen house. Who do you think is going to get the eggs?
The wolves.
Absolutely.
When you let a beaner guard the border, you think the border is going to be very secure?
Well, Christians were too busy watching football. Oh, by the way, the Jews own all the football teams, too. And the television that it's aired on.
It's like having your daughter go on a date and asking a pimp to chaperone.
Yeah, it's incredible that the levels of apathy and ignorance in Christendom are incredible. But, yeah, you know, Revelation 17:17, Yahweh would give us one heart and one mind to hand our kingdom over to the beast. Christians, we as Christians have a duty to hate it, but we have to understand that it's the word of God that it would happen.
All right. For this reason, no reforms were to be advocated. On the contrary, quote, every effort is to be made to heighten and increase the evil and sorrows, which will at length wear out the patience of the people and encourage an insurrection en masse. Quote, the second category of the association was therefore to be composed of people to whom we concede life provisionally in order that by a series of monstrous acts they may drive the people into inevitable revolt. In other words, oppressors of the people were to be encouraged. Translation, they're going to encourage horrible abuses on the part of capitalist Jews, aren't they?
Absolutely. I can't find anything on his Netchev character.
Instead of bombing the house of the owner at the mill, who happens to be a Jewish capitalist, they're going to encourage him, so he pushes the workers right into their arms.
I did find something on Netchev.
All right, would you like to read it?
It's not succinct enough.
All right.
It's a really long story, and it looks like it's really...
Is there a synopsis? Is he a Jew or not?
Well, right. There's no synopsis. There's nothing. It's more or less a diatribe on anarchism and revolution.
I think we would have to conclude from his rhetoric about destroying the world that can only come from the mind of a perverse Jew. As Jared would say, the product of a Jewish mind. I mean, even the most disgusting white anarchists, they don't talk about destroying the world. They talk about destroying institutions of state control, but not the very world itself. I mean, Nechayev says, live in this world only in order to annihilate it. Isn't that what the Jews live for? They live to destroy.
Well, yes, it fits the entire pattern, but so is Bakunin, and Bakunin is evidently not a Jew. What we also see in this world that we have many Christians, or non-Jews at least, who are totally deceived by the Jews and caught up, readers of Jewish literature who were caught up and programmed by Jewish ideals.
All right.
And many of our own people here in this country are totally deceived and caught up in Jewish ideals.
To the sane mind, it is almost impossible to believe that any man could put forward such theories. But this is precisely the advantage obtained by the advocates of world revolution. Their doctrines are so monstrous that they appear unbelievable to the world in general. Yet here is no possibility of misrepresentation, for the Revolutionary Catechism may be seen in print by anyone who cares to look at it. But like many another conspirator, from Weishaupt onwards, Bakunin found himself outwitted by his coadjutor. Perfectly unscrupulous as to the means he employed, he had at first welcomed Chayef as a force, but by degrees he came to realize the danger he himself incurred by allying himself with a man who failed to recognize even the principle of honor among thieves. Well, truly, there is no honor among thieves. If you're with a group full of violent backstabbers, expect a knife in your back.
Right.
And can evil cast out evil? Satan's kingdom's divided against itself. Towards 1870, Bakunin discovered that Nechayev, whilst pretending to be his most devoted disciple, had all the while been a member of another society still more secret than the Alliance Sociale-Democratique, and of which he had never divulged the inner mysteries to his master. Nechayev, Bakunin wrote to Talandier, is a devoted fanatic, but at the same time a very dangerous fanatic, and one with whom an alliance could only be disastrous to everyone. This is why. He was first a member of an occultic committee, which really had existed in Russia. This committee no longer exists. All its members have been arrested, except Nechayev, it seems. Nechayev alone remains, and alone he constitutes what he calls the committee. I'm wondering if he had a hand in the arrest of all the other members.
Well, it seems to me that he was eventually taken prisoner and spent the rest of his life in prison in Russia.
Even after the Bolsheviks came to power, or didn't he live that long?
I don't think he lived that long.
All right. The Russian organization having been destroyed, he is trying to create a new one abroad. All this would be perfectly natural, legitimate, and yet very useful, but the way he goes to work is detestable. Keenly impressed by the catastrophe which has just destroyed the secret organization in Russia, he has gradually arrived at the conclusion that in order to found a serious and indestructible society, one must take for a basis the policy of Machiavelli and adopt in full the system of the Jesuits, bodily violence and a lying soul. Quote, truth, mutual confidence, serious and severe solidarity exist only between about 10 individuals who form the sanctum sanctorum of the society. All the rest must serve as a blind instrument and as matter to be exploited by the hands of these 10 men really solidarized. It is permitted and even ordered that one should deceive them, compromise them, steal from them, and even if needs be, ruin them. They are conspiracy fodder. Chair a conspiration. And that seems straight out of the Talmud. Lie, cheat, rob, steal, and kill. Do whatever you need. Straight out of the Talmud, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Nechayev was convicted by a Moscow court and condemned to hard labor.
Probably the only time he ever worked in his life.
He was not sent either to Siberia or to any hard labor prison. Immediately after the condemnation, he was simply immured in the Alexis Ravelin. And has remained there since 1874, according to this.
Well, so he was probably long dead when the Bolsheviks came to power.
Right. This is a chapter in a book, In Russian and French Prisons, by Peter Alexeyevich Kropotkin, and that's a name that we should find in the pages of Nestor Webster also.
All right. Then Bakunin goes on to describe Nechayev's methods. In the name of the cause, he must get hold of your whole person without your knowing it. In order to do this, he will spy on you and try to get hold of your secrets. And for that purpose, in your absence, left alone in your room, he will open all your drawers, read all your correspondence, and when a letter seems interesting to him, that is to say, compromising from any point of view for you or for one of your friends, he will seal it and keep it carefully as a document against you or against your friend. When convicted of this in a general assembly, he dared to say to us, well, yes, it is our system. We consider as enemies, whom it is our duty to deceive and compromise, all those who are not completely with us. If you have introduced him to a friend, his first thought will be to raise discord, gossip, and intrigue between you. In a word, to make you quarrel. Your friend has a wife, a daughter. He will try to seduce her, to give her a child, in order to drag her away from official morality and throw her into an attitude of forced revolutionary protest against society. All personal ties, all friendships, are considered by them as an evil, which it is their duty to destroy, because all this constitutes a force which, being outside the secret organization, diminishes the unique force of the latter. Do not cry out that I am exaggerating. All this has been amply developed and proved by me. Well, they don't want you having friends because you might not want to kill your friends in the new revolution.
Right. I'm looking right now at the pages of a French book on Nechayev, which was written more recently. But it's on Google Books. It's incomplete, and it's only in French. And apparently, I could read enough of it. It was written in, it was copyrighted in 1989. And I could read enough of it to know that Nechayev died in the prison, in prison in 1884. But and he looks like it. He doesn't look like he's Germanic. He looks like a Jew to me. But he doesn't. There's no saying, and it doesn't look like this is going to tell me. And it's in French anyway. So it, even if I could read the whole thing, it would be difficult to pick out.
All right.
But he died in 1884 in prison.
Okay. It will be seen that all these were the exact principles and methods laid down by Weishaupt for the Illuminati. Now it is curious to find the description of the inner ring of secret intrigue described by Bakunin in the above-quoted letter exactly corroborated by a very different authority, namely the book of Guguenot de Musiau, entitled Les Juifs, le Judaisme et la Judaisation des Peuples Chrétiens, which means the Jews, Judaism, and the Judaization of the peoples, or the pupils of something. I can't decipher that. Do you know what those last two words are?
Chrétiens, that looks like the Judaization of the Christian people.
Okay.
That's what it looks like to me, and because I've seen that S drop out of the word Christian in French. I think that means Christians. Now this is evidently somebody sees that all of this communism is the Judaization of Christendom, and that was in 1869, right?
Yes, published just a year earlier in 1869.
Guguenot de Musiau.
Entitled The Jews, Judaism, and the Judaization of the Christian Peoples. It was in December 1865, that is to say, a year after Bakunin had formed his alliance in conjunction with Nechayev, that de Musiau received a letter from a Protestant statesman in the service of a great Germanic power, saying, since the revolutionary recrudescence of 1845, I have had relations with a Jew who, from vanity, betrayed the secret of the secret societies with which he had been associated, and who warned me 8 or 10 days beforehand of all the revolutions which were about to break out at any point of Europe. I owe to him the unshakable conviction that all these movements of, quote, oppressed people, quote, et cetera, are devised by half a dozen individuals who give their orders to the secret societies of all Europe. The ground is absolutely mined beneath our feet, and the Jews provide a large contingent of these miners. The Jewish bankers will soon be, although their prodigious fortunes are lords and masters, all the great radical newspapers of Germany are in the hands of Jews. And I'm wondering, is this a relationship he had as in a friendship, or he had relations with a Jew as in he's gay?
Well, listen to this. A devout Catholic and political legitimist associated with Ultramontanism, Henri Guguenot de Musiau was a noble who served in the court of Charles X of France in the 1820s. After the Revolution of 1830, he retreated to a chateau in Coulmiers and devoted his time to the study of what he considered the greatest dangers of the day, the Talmud, the occult, Freemasonry, and Satanism. This guy had it nailed. Guguenot's most famous anti-Jewish tract was a book entitled The Jew, Judaism, and the Judaization of the Christian Peoples, which legitimizes my translation there, and published in 1869. The book received only limited attention at the time of its publication and did not sell well. Well, of course, no Jew book merchant wanted to touch it.
They're not going to publish it or promote it.
Well, right. Somebody published it, but they sure as hell aren't going to put it on his store shelves.
Although
it won the blessing of Pope Pius IX and appealed to the French ultramontanists, which we have to remember were mostly Catholics, right? The French people.
Yes.
The book came into its own in the 1870s in Austria, Hungary, and Romania, where political anti-Semitism was gaining a foothold at the time. I wonder why. And it became more important in France after 1886 when the leader of French political anti-Semitism, Edouard Drumont, helped bring out a new edition. The university – now that's from a book that's from a book on a Google book search called Anti-Semitism, a Historical Encyclopedia of Prejudice and Persecution. Remember I was talking earlier in this program about Jew control over the media and how they've spun all our history? Well, here you have it. That the University of Massachusetts calls him one of anti-Semitism's earlier proponents. Okay, I'm done with De Mousseau. I mean, it's plain on its face.
And Wiki lists him as an anti-Semite. And a conspiracy theorist.
Well, it has nothing to do behind it. Yeah, you know, with the Jews being behind every revolution in Europe ever since the French Revolution, right? And even revolutions before that, probably. Every revolution in Europe, the Jew was behind in order to usurp European society for himself. That's perfectly clear from all of these chapters of Nestor Webster we've written. And when people wake up to it, they're branded as anti-Semites.
So Mousseau is a hate monger for figuring out what the Jews are about.
Right. They're not anti-antichrists. They're anti-Semites. Mousseau, to me, is clearly an anti-antichrist.
All right. It is impossible to suppose any collusion between men of opinions so divergent as the royalist Catholic de Mousseau, his friend the Protestant statesman, and the Russian anarchists Bakunin and Nechayev. We must therefore admit that each must have reached his conclusions independently of the other, and the extraordinary similarity between their two accounts tends most certainly to confirm the assertion that this mysterious association really existed. Of whom was it composed? According to De Mousseau, it was largely controlled by Jews who had insinuated themselves into the Masonic lodges and secret societies, and curiously enough, it was in October of this same year, 1869, that Bakunin, who had been attacked by certain Jews in the Internationale, wrote his Study on the German Jews, where he repeats precisely the same story of Jewish intrigue.
Well, he wasn't allowed to have the supreme control that he wanted by the Jews, so now he's got to tell on them, right?
The passage in question runs as follows. I begin by begging you to believe that I am in no way the enemy nor the detractor of the Jews. Well, he has to say that because 90% of his audience is Jewish. Although I may be considered a cannibal, I do not carry savagery to that point. And I assure you that in my eyes, all nations have their worth.
Don't the Jews slander all their opposition as cannibals?
Absolutely.
If you're an if you're anti-Jewish or an anti-Antichrist, if they brand you an anti-Semite, they brand you as a savage, a cannibal, an animal, and everything else that goes with it, right? Everything that they do is what they attribute to you.
And they mock the Eucharist and call you a cannibal for the body and blood of Christ.
Yes.
And when has he respected the worth of all nations? Don't they say that nations shouldn't even exist, that nations have no right to exist? They're just the international Jewish cabal.
Absolutely. The world's oldest crime ring ruling over everything. That's their goal. That's the only thing that has a right to exist in the mind of the Jew.
You know, it's just one big crime family, and they have regional outlets. You know, here's the Jewish crime family in North America, the Jewish crime family in Europe, but it's all under the control of some Jew somewhere in the world. Each is, moreover, an ethnographically historic product, and it is consequently responsible neither for its faults nor its merits. It is thus that we may observe in connection with the modern Jews that their nature lends itself little to frank socialism. Their history, long before the Christian era, implanted in them an essentially mercantile and bourgeois tendency, with the result that, considered as a nation, they are par excellence the exploiters of other men's work.
Now this isn't, you know, this comes from confusion over the identity of the Jews, okay? Because all throughout Hebrew history, recorded in the Old Testament, the word Canaanite was synonymous with the word merchant.
Absolutely.
And that's who the Jews really are. They're the Canaanites of the Old Testament. They've always been merchants because they can't create anything on their own. They have to manipulate markets and find other people's fruits to profit from.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's in the book of Hosea where it says he is a merchant. The balances of deceit are in his hands. He loves to deceive. And some translations say he is of Canaan.
Well, right. That's because the words merchant, Canaanite became synonymous with merchants because the Canaanites were such ruthlessly successful merchants.
So today we might as well just call bankers Jews or Jews bankers.
Well, it's all the same.
You know, I need to go down to the bank and get a loan from the Jew instead of saying I need to get a loan from the banker.
Well, people used to say I'm going to go get a loan from the Jew. Then they legitimized their trade, and we started calling them bankers. That was our fault, not theirs, that we accepted their legitimacy.
We stamped our approval on their immorality.
Yes, we did.
They are par excellence the exploiters of other men's work, and they have a natural horror and fear of the popular masses whom they despise. Moreover, whether openly or in secret, the habit of exploitation, whilst developing the intelligence of the exploiters, gives it an exclusive and disastrous bent, and quite contrary to the interests as well as to the instincts of the proletariat. I know that in expressing with this frankness my intimate opinion on the Jews, I expose myself to enormous dangers. Many people share it, but very few dare publicly to express it. For the Jewish sect, very much more formidable than that of the Jesuits, Catholic or Protestant,
because they're behind them all by this time.
Exactly. Constitutes today a veritable power in Europe. It reigns despotically in commerce, in the banks, and it has invaded three-quarters of German journalism and a very considerable portion of the journalism of other countries. Woe then to him who has the clumsiness to displease it. But Bakunin had underestimated the control of the Jews over the press. The great anarchist might tilt with impunity against principalities and powers, might incite to murder, pillage, and rebellion, but the moment he attempted to attack the Jews, he was unable to obtain a hearing, and his polemique never saw the light until his works were published 30 or 40 years later. The same failure had attended the efforts of the Hibbertist Triton, who at about the same date wrote a denunciation of the Jews, which could not be published during his lifetime. It will be seen that for all their destructive energy, the French and Russian anarchists were no match for the German Jews of the Internationale, into which Bakunin and his alliance had been admitted in August 1869. Indeed, Bakunin clearly stood in awe of Marx, for in the above-quoted letter, he is careful to specify that he includes in his strictures only the crowd of Jewish pygmies who had penetrated into the socialist movement, and exempts the two Jewish giants, Marx and LaSalle. And 10 months earlier, he had written to Marx himself in terms of the most servile flattery. You ask whether I continue to be your friend. Yes, more than ever, dear Marx. You see, dear friend, that I am your disciple, and I am proud of it.
So Bakunin was reduced to the level of useful idiot.
He's just a Jewish, you know, bootlicker.
Yeah, just another useful idiot. Expendable boy.
In a letter to Herzen on October 28, 1869, Bakunin explains his attitude to Marx and his reason for conferring on him the title of giant. Marx, who detests me and who I imagine loves no one but himself, is nevertheless a man very useful to the International. If at the present moment I had undertaken a war against Marx, three-quarters of the members of the International would have turned against me, and I should have been at a disadvantage. So they're shaking hands, but each one has a knife in the other hand. Although from the beginning, Marx had hoped to make the Working Men's Association the instrument of his personal views, it was not until 1868 that he succeeded in definitely directing its policies along his line of state socialism. At the first two congresses of Geneva in 1866 and Lausanne in 1867, the theories of the French Proudhonians still prevailed. The Congress at Brussels in 1868 showed, however, the parting of the ways by declaring that the machines and instruments of work should belong to the workers, but all public services, railways, mines, etc., to the community. This program was therefore a blend of the system later to be known as syndicalism and of the communism of Vidal and Puquiere, which had been adopted by Marx. At the Fourth Congress in Basel in 1869, the policy of the association veered still further towards communism by the abolition of private property and land and of inheritance. The program of Weishaupt had thus been accepted almost in its entirety by the International. Freiburg, who with the other French workers of the association opposed the abolition of private property and land, points out that the history of the International must be divided into two periods. The first, up to the Congress of Lucerne, mutualist, that is to say, demanding free control of industry. The second period, Russo-German, when the association became communist, that is to say, authoritative. From this policy, as also from the principle of class hatred upheld both by Marx and Bakunin, Freiburg disassociates himself and his comrades entirely. "I insist," he writes, "that it should be known that no upright mind could have conceived the idea of giving birth to a society of war and hatred," end quote. And since this is what it had become, Freiburg declares that by 1869, the Internationale of the French founders was dead, quite dead. The Working Men's International, remarks Düring, was no longer working class in the sense that it maneuvered, used, and exploited the workers of different countries. Such, then, were the intrigues of the men who called themselves the champions of the proletariat. All talk of conditions of labor, all discussion of the practical problems of industry had been abandoned, and the Internationale simply became an engine of warfare against civilization.
Well, people that spend their lives avoiding work, how could they possibly
champion the cause of the workers?
How could they champion the cause of the workers? How could they conceive the need of workmen and tradesmen? They can't even conceive what they need to do their job and to produce their products. If you've never worked for a living, you can't. I mean, it's outside the bounds of your experience.
Absolutely. By its absorption of the secret societies and of the doctrines of Illuminism, all the machinery of revolution passed into its keeping. Every move in the game devised by Weishaupt, every method for engineering disturbances and for spreading inflammatory propaganda became part of its program. So just as the Jacobin Club had openly executed the hidden plan of the Illuminati, the International, holding within it the same terrible secrets, carried on the work of world revolution in the full light of day.
That's how they do it, right in front of everybody, and nobody does anything about it.
All right, so shall we pick this up at a later point?
Well, yes, that's the end of Nestor Webster's chapter on the Internationale, and when we commence with this program, next week you need to be off, right?
Yes, I won't be around.
And when we commence with this program, we'll pick it up with the Revolution of 1871.
Excellent. All right, then.
Thank you.
Yahweh bless.
Yahweh.
Thank you.